Welcome to a podcast of the cinema. You know, we were being so chatty beforehand, we didn't get to sit down and make a list of the movies we're covering.
I made the list.
Really?
Yeah.
You made it by yourself.
I did.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know what? I do a lot of things by myself.
I'm going to check your work later and see how that...
I'll give it to you right now.
Well, hey, let's introduce ourselves, let's introduce our guests, and then we'll get to that. I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
Begin the show with doubt. Of me,
well,
and
my
abilities.
I usually do it without saying it out loud, but I thought I would sort of bring people in to my process of what has Dave White not done now? How's he ruined everything? I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film reviews editor.
I'm bored with you already.
I'm film reviews editor for The Wrap and film critic on What the Flick on the YouTube network The Young Turks.
I'm the guy that ruins everything. Apparently.
I'm going to move that plate so it doesn't
smash onto the floor.
You did not ruin these chocolate chip muffins, which were delicious.
Oh, exactly. Oh, look. There's a thing that I'm super great at.
Making chocolate chip making and saying chocolate chip muffins from the Huckleberry Cookbook.
And who are you?
My name is Dave White. Chef, master baking person.
Mm.
Film critic on hiatus from linoleum-knife.com.
Yes.
Soon to return after I finish writing a lot of different other things.
Including a new story that you added to your life this week. We could talk about that later, too.
You know, that really is going in the book.
Oh, I hope so.
Because it's one of a series of events, of unfortunate events, that I perpetrate on myself.
Before we get into that...
Can I even hear myself?
Just turn yourself up. There we go. You're doing fine. Let's introduce our guest. We're thrilled to have with us a good friend and a friend of the show, Bill Neal.
Woo! Yay! Hello.
Y'all don't know who he is.
Editor at Buddha Jones Trailers. You may recall recently we were talking about how incredible the Krampus trailer is and how that trailer has made us super, super excited to see the movie. That is Bill's handiwork.
Thank you very much. Yes, it's me. I'm excited it made you excited.
That trailer played before Crimson Peak on Thursday night.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience seemed excited.
Oh, good.
They also seemed excited about the Seth Rogen throwing up movie. What was it?
The Night Before.
The Christmas movie.
Yeah, there's three big Christmas movies this year. There's Krampus, there's The Night Before, and there's something called Love the Millers, I think.
Love the Coopers.
We're the Millers.
Yeah, We're the Millers, Love the Coopers.
We're the Millers, Love the Coopers.
Right.
And Krampus.
Yes, Love the Krampus. I mean, really, you had me at It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year at the beginning there, but then it got funny and scary and, you know. And I got to watch, I got to watch Trick or Treat because I still have never seen
it. You've never seen it. It's great. And I love Trick or Treat. I love Mike Doherty. He's a friend of mine. So I was really happy to work. I worked on Trick or Treat.
Oh, nice.
I did the trailer for that and I got to do the trailer for Krampus, too. So, that's
Coolio.
Good.
All right. So, yeah, I totally want to grill you about how trailers work and how you're totally lying to everyone. but first, I think Dave needs to share his new story this week.
Okay. So, you know, there's that thing where you're in Target and you're at the magazines. Which, by the way, have shrunken.
Oh, yeah. They're like stashed in the back of the book section.
They have smallered the magazines by about 50%.
But what they have now...
Egon was right. Print is dying.
Is the...
or dead.
They have the gourmet magazine cookie issue. The holiday cookies.
And I pick it up because it has a new front.
Yeah.
Not so much new inside.
No.
It looks just like last year's gourmet cookie issue.
Which is a recurring theme now with the Christmas issues.
Yep.
Ah.
Because we picked up the Southern Living Christmas issue.
We did.
A lot of recycling.
There's a thing that happens.
Do they think we're not going to notice?
This thing in this house, once October hits and the Christmas recipe special issues of magazines come out, like Southern Living and Gourmet and all the other food magazines and lifestyle magazines, we buy them. Mm-hmm. You never know.
I do that with Halloween stuff.
You never know what's going to happen in the magazine, what kind of recipe you're going to need to make for all your friends. We have a lot of people coming over here in December. And so I'm looking through the cookie magazine, and I'm thinking, I've seen these cookies before. These are familiar cookies to me.
I open Deja up, cookies.
I show Alonzo, blah, 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 cookie repeatings.
Those lazy editors at the magazine.
And then, well, you know, they're just trying to save some money. Yeah. And then on comes, on the Target stereo, that new, well, it's not new anymore, but that new Carly Rae Jepsen song. I really, 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 really like you, Tom Hanks.
Yes, that one.
Yeah.
Tom Hanks is in parentheses, I think.
We begin start
busting a move.
Interpretive dancing in Target. I'm holding the magazine. I'm trying to put the magazine back in the rack, although it's under the second, it's the second rack, and you, it's up in the back, so you gotta like
angle it in,
and then put it down. And I don't know, I'm doing that, and at the same time,
he's dancing,
doing a little dance, I started to fall, and I grabbed the top magazine rack, thinking this will support me.
And these are not like the big wooden racks they have at Barnes & Noble. These are like bolted to the wall with tiny screws.
I'm light as a feather.
On wings of gossamer.
I'm like Misty Copeland of the American Ballet Theater. That top magazine rack just crumbled. All the magazines come pouring down.
An avalanche of Maxims.
So, failing that, as I sort of roll into the fall, I grab the second rack of magazines, thinking, this will certainly be what I need to stop my plummeting Hulk to the earth. That one gives way. More magazines pour down onto the floor, onto me.
I don't know if it actually happened in slow motion or it just looked that way to me, but there seemed to be about eight stages of you and gravity
slowly
battling it out and spinning and catching.
I was rolling myself down, like trying to catch myself and trying to make it go as slowly as possible so I didn't like crash.
And I'm behind the giant red plastic shopping cart, so I can't reach in time while
he's still dancing.
Slow motion disaster is taking place in front of me.
He's still dancing.
And I was in the moment.
And
like Misty Copeland.
So then I fall down.
Go boom.
Go boom.
With a lot of magazines on.
The magazines everywhere.
Cushioning his fall.
You know, when you're in Target and you're looking for a price confirmation from somebody, any employee to help you. They can't be found. But the minute you are the old fat man falling to the floor, they come running.
That's true. I've never seen such service.
Wow. They're like, sir, are you okay? Yeah, I'm just stupid. Fine. And they're like, do you need to sit down for a minute? Like, no.
They thought it was a seizure.
No, I'm just actually an idiot.
Would you like a new hip from our Liza Minnelli collection?
Yeah, right. And I'm like, well, in my lawsuit, I'm going to name Carly Rae Jepsen.
And Gourmet Magazine.
Yeah. No, that's what they're about. They're like, oh, no, and it's
Oh, yeah.
And so I was like,
you're looking for, like, spilled milk on the floor, probably. You know?
I'm fine. I just... I'm a dumb, clumsy person. And then...
Was the issue of Fangoria that you're in?
No, they don't.
Not on the shelves.
They don't carry that. They barely carry Fangoria anywhere.
Right.
I know. I had
we mail ordered one, I think.
I had to hunt and hunt and hunt to find it. It was at Barnes & Noble, eventually. It was at some other newsstand, like one of those street newsstands. Mm-hmm. They had it.
I had a hard time finding the Time magazine with Bernie Sanders on the cover.
Right.
Like, it's just like, sad. It's trying to find, you know, like, replacement strings for your harpsichord.
Right. The same thing about Fangoria is the online doesn't have the stuff that's in the printed edition. So
correct.
I don't think we can see the article you wrote.
I just learned that this week. Yeah. I thought, I'm going to go look for my article online.
And link to it.
At Fangoria.com. And no, it's not there. If you want to read the article I wrote about my obsession with the movie The Strangers.
You got to kill some trees.
You got to go find that issue on the Hannibal issue.
Yeah, I'm in that issue too. They
interviewed
me.
Exactly.
And I did the trailer for The Strangers.
You're in that.
Well, all right then. It all comes.
It all comes together.
You made the trailer that enticed me to see it, and you included the scene that to this day freaks me out the hardest. The
best scene in the movie.
The best scene in the movie. Yeah. So much space in that shot.
Yeah,
and so much silence, and it gets me every time.
Right. When I saw that, when I watched that movie for the first time, and I saw that scene right then in my head, I was like, "That's the main moment of the trailer."
Mm-hmm. That's I'm glad we segued because I wanted to. This is exactly the kind of stuff.
So naturally, too.
I know it's so organic. So When you watch a movie for the first time, generally it's a rough cut,
super rough, or from dailies. Okay. Sometimes we get all the dailies before there's even a rough cut.
Wow, now and are you just a horror guy, and is that by choice?
No. Okay. I have been a lifelong horror fan, and when I first started doing trailers back in the 90s, I've been doing it a while. I was kind of a comedy guy. I did like Rush Hour movies. I did one of the Austin Powers.
Oh wow.
One of the first trailers I ever cut was When a Man Loves a Woman. Remember that? Meg Ryan and Andy Garcia, who's an alcoholic.
When a Woman Wants an Oscar.
Yeah, Waiting to Exhale, I did. I worked a lot with Disney and with Fox, and they didn't have a lot of horror movies. Actually, the 90s were a terrible time for horror in terms of just amount of content.
Right. Until Scream came out.
Scream, yes. But I never really got a chance to work on horror till about 15 years ago. I did a couple trailers here or there, but then I did a trailer for the movie, the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Okay.
And that trailer just got a lot of attention. People thought it was a great trailer. I'm actually really proud of it. Hmm. And that put me on the map, and kind of that was the resurgence of horror. So then I started getting offered tons of horror movies to cut the trailer for, and so I kind of became the horror guy, and I was super happy to become the horror guy. I love being in that niche, and I do a lot of other, you know, genres. I worked on The Wolf of Wall Street. I did that trailer, trailer for Flight. And then what we also, you know, the way the trailer business works is there's a bunch of companies that do it. There's like 50 out there.
Right.
I work for one of them, Buddha Jones Trailers. But for any movie that comes out, they hire 2, 3, 4 companies to each cut a trailer, or multiple trailers per company.
So spec, basically.
No, they pay everybody
to
do it.
Oh, they do. Okay.
But if you don't get your work seen, if it doesn't get the finish, which means the one that goes out into the world, you've just spent 4 months of your life doing something that nobody sees. It's like writing something and then no one ever gets to see it. There's no, you know, you want it to get the finish. Mm-hmm. But so anytime, so they send it to a few companies, and then, you know, we all submit. The studios, the marketing executives of the studios are a huge part and a creative part of it, and they're not all just cynical, like, you know, people. They're, you know, there's a lot of, you know, thought and care for it. But we send it to the execs. They go up many versions. They test them. They go to filmmakers. It's a long process of a bunch of trailers. They start to whittle them down. And then finally, depending on testing numbers, this is like market testing, where they market test.
Sure, yeah. Kind of
going really fast. But then they end up picking one. So I've been lucky that I've had a lot of my trailers finished. But a lot of my, you know, anytime you've seen a trailer on screen, it's... there's like 3 others that didn't get up there.
Wow. Okay.
With like a different kind of focus or, you know, pushing, you know, if it's a comedy, if it's a family comedy, maybe it's pushing the comedy harder. Maybe the slapstick's being pushed harder in the trailer that finished as opposed to maybe pushing the heart.
Right.
Or something like that. So they have different ways of approaching things.
Now, what's the, what kind of, or does it depend from film to film in terms of like, what you can and can't give away. Like you just talked about using the best shot from the strangers in the trailer. Right.
Yeah, but that doesn't give anything away.
Right. But I feel like a lot of trailers are almost telling you the whole, all three acts, you know? So I'm wondering, does it differ in terms of what the studio asks for, or are there certain genres where you want to give away more and other ones where you want to not, you know?
I mean, I think everybody involved in the process, studio, filmmakers, the trailer editors, everybody wants to give away as little as possible. And usually where we start out in version one, and usually we end up finishing at version 50. Yeah. And that's if we don't restart all over again. You try and show as little as possible to get the feel and the focus of the movie, you know, to communicate it properly. And then what kind of happens is they test the trailers, they send them out, and they test them around the country. They, you know, they go to, like, just like market testing for anything.
Sure.
They get people's opinions. And there's a certain number that people want. I mean, the marketing company wants to reach a certain number, but people say how interested they are in the movie. What ends up happening is they get the first set of numbers back, and they're okay, but they want to push them. How do you push them? You tell people more story, more story, more story. And yes, the studio doesn't want to give away necessarily that much story, but also it's kind of covering their ass too. It's a huge investment. So sure, they want something that says, that tells them that people want to see this movie. And in general, the general public tends to like to know what they're getting.
Right.
And the studio wants to cast as broad a net as possible to get as many people in. And that might mean, you know, pushing certain aspects of a story. Like, I didn't work on this campaign, but it's kind of a good example. I think August Osage County, the trailer really kind of pushed the comedy of that movie. And it's in there, but the trailer was, you know, pushed a lot harder because that's obviously, I'm sure they did a trailer that was much more dramatic and heavier. And when you put it out there, way more people responded and said, I'm definitely going to go see this movie opening weekend if the trailer was more comedy.
I see.
So that's where that comes from. And then
the poster could just have Meryl Streep being choked to death
by Julia Roberts.
Julia Roberts. Honestly, that's what sold me on that movie.
For people, I'm probably a lot of people listening to this podcast, you guys, people like me, you know, the general a teaser, not necessarily, which is kind of the shorter thing that comes out way before a movie, but a trailer, a full trailer. If you're going to see the movie, if you're already interested in the movie, like if I'm interested in, I don't know, a movie coming out soon, I can't even think of one, but if I already know I want to see it, I don't watch the trailer. And I think if anybody who is interested in a movie knows they want to go see it, don't watch the trailer because you're convinced.
Yeah, you don't need to be sold extra.
Yeah, it's
extra,
not going
to,
you know, necessarily add to your experience.
The Star Wars trailer comes out this week, and I, you know, unless what the flick makes me, I'm not going to watch it.
What I always do is I watch you're gonna see it, and then I watch the trailer after I've come home.
Yeah, and because it's really interesting to see how what they had to do, and sometimes it's really, you know, I find watching other trailers for movies I didn't work on, or even movies I did work on where I didn't get the finish, and I see something else somebody did, some kind of manipulation, not necessarily in faking it, but in getting the idea of the story out. Because it can be really hard, you know? And like, tonally, it's really hard. Some movies are complex, like even just comedy horror movies, like Krampus.
Yeah.
Was, you know, I'm really glad that it all came together. But that's tough, because comedy and horror, in 2.5 minutes, it's really difficult to convey the nuances of certain movies. And that's why we, you know.
I've seen trailers after the fact where you can tell they cobble together like two different lines from two different scenes just to explain a plot point quickly.
I have put words together. I have made 7-word sentences from single words from around the movie. I'm like, I need this person to say this. You know? And it's not in terms of cheating. It's just we have to get the idea out.
The information.
Yeah, and nobody wants to spoil anybody's experience. I mean, what good is it if on open you get people to go to the opening night and then they tell their friends, oh, you've seen everything in the trailer. Right. It doesn't, and you don't want people, because that is a reaction a lot of people have after they see the trailer. Well, like, I don't need to see the movie now. Yeah,
like crappy comedies a lot of times. Like, well, you've seen everything funny in this movie already.
You know? Or you've seen stuff that's not in the movie, which...
I was going to ask if you'd had a real genius balloon chair moment where you put something in the trailer and then it wound up not...
Yes, there's been times where... Yeah, what happens is because, like I said, sometimes we work from dailies before there's even a rough cut of the movie. Sure. So, and that's a lot of work for us. It's hundreds of hours, and we have to watch everything, especially on comedies. And that's kind of why I'm glad I'm not doing as many comedies, because comedies, every take will be something different.
Right.
You know, and so, therefore, you know, the movie's not cut together, but the trailer has to go out before the movie is locked.
Right.
So people, you know, there might be a scene that's in the movie, in the rough cut of the movie, the 3-hour rough cut. And then when the trailer comes out, when the movie comes out, that scene that's in the trailer has been cut from the movie, and nobody intended that. No one's like, you know, trying to fake it.
Sure, no, no.
I think I just saw, what was it, Goosebumps. I watched it for this, and I watched the trailer when I got home, and I was like, I saw a scene that wasn't in the movie, which I think, unless I
that sounds right, actually. I think so.
Yeah.
This goes all the way back to, we just did a Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode about Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. Mm-hmm. What was that, 1953?
Yeah.
There are scenes in the trailer that are not in the film of that.
Well, the really weird thing, and of course the Apple, you know, has like the deleted musical sequences in the trailer that aren't in the movie. But what I've noticed about watching old trailers, and I don't know if it's just Fox or in general, but you'll see where they had to use alternate takes in the trailer, like they somehow weren't allowed to use what was in the movie, or I don't know the reasoning behind it was.
As a movie is edited, you know, they change out the takes. So an early cut of the movie might have one performance. I actually remember when I first discovered that was that first trailer, When a Man Loves a Woman. I can talk about. Sometimes we have to be a little
discreet
about. But this is 25 years ago. But I remember when I saw the rough cut of the movie when it was called Significant Other.
Right.
And I thought Meg Ryan was amazing in it. And I remember I saw it as the
she's listening, by the way.
As the movie went along, they kept changing the takes. I was like, that take isn't as good, but she wasn't as cryy, and she looked less horrible. You know, and I was I mean, that's not usually it's for performance that they edit, but things the movie evolves over months and months and months. We're there the whole time.
Interesting.
And there's been times when I've seen a finished movie, and after the trailers come out, and I shake my head because I'm so like half the trailer is different than the movie.
Do you feel like you've ever cut a trailer for a movie that wound up just being something else entirely in terms of tone or like what characters they concentrated on or anything?
I don't know. Not tone, but I know I cut a trailer for the movie Dreamhouse a few years ago.
A trailer I'm glad I didn't see beforehand, because that gives away the story.
Yes. the thing is, what happened with that movie, I think I can be transparent about that, is that the movie just evolved over time, and kind of where the twist happened was different in earlier cuts of the movie.
So it's less of a reveal.
And yes, and I think in that trailer, we legitimately thought that's one twist, but there's so much more that happens after that.
And then they were like, now that's going to be it.
And that was not our intention.
Yeah, that's a movie that doesn't work, but you can see, in real estate terms, you can see the bones of a movie that would have worked. Like somewhere along the way, they didn't come together, but there's some cool ideas and some good performances.
And actually, that kind of perception of any movie is how we take every movie. Like people go, how do you work on movies that are terrible? I can't.
You don't know it's terrible.
I can't judge it because they're too rough, and I find things that I love in the movie. And
you're kind of making the movie you want to see in a way. Or out of the material
that everybody thinks, and the marketing people in the studio believe in. I mean, people believe even in the worst movies.
Sure.
You know, and it's hard to tell. And there have been times where I'm like, I think that movie's not going to be so good. It comes out and gets great reviews. I'm like, okay, well.
And speaking of which, you cut the trailer for Crimson. Oh, okay. Sorry, I was going to segue, but I won't now.
I want to find the people who cut the new trailer
for Dangerous Men.
Dangerous Men, which will be coming out in November.
November, right?
I cannot wait. I'm a bad movie aficionado, as you guys know.
They made that new trailer that Drafthouse put out this past week.
that trailer makes the film look
coherent.
Like, right. It makes the film look like, oh yeah, well, here's this, that, this happens, and then this happens, and this happens. This movie is about this thing. No, it ain't.
Well, why would they do it for that movie? It's not like they're trying to appeal to a broad audience. They're trying to get us who wants it to not to make sense. Well,
believe me, the stuff in it still makes it very clear that it's a terrible movie. But in the way that the scenes are arranged and sequenced, it does imbue the film with a logic that it does not have.
Well, then the editor of that trailer just had to have, like, you know, a piece of film.
I watched it twice. Because I'm like... Wow, this looks like it's an actual real movie.
Yes.
Now, you know, this trailer makes it look like, oh, you're going to go see a film that makes sense. It don't.
No, you're not. Doesn't matter. You'll love it anyway.
Am I going to love it?
Oh yeah.
We've seen it. How many times have we seen it?
Four times now. Because we saw it during its actual initial run.
It's 1 week run in 2006. Yeah.
It's that recent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ah. And then it was Cinefamily did it several times.
Yeah.
And now it's finally getting released.
I can't wait.
It's bonkers. Yeah. So it's a wonderful experience.
And completely earnest, right? That's what I love about it.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Okay, now.
Now,
what you're going to say is you cut the trailer for
Crimson Peak.
Crimson Peak.
Which opened this week.
We both love Crimson Peak.
Yes. I'm hearing a lot of naysaying about it, which I don't understand.
From who?
People. The net, you know.
I ain't people.
Exactly. You are a shimmering star in the cinematic firmament. So Crimson Peak, a new film from Guillermo del Toro, which he co-wrote with Matthew Robbins, and it is a sort of loving homage to the Hammer films. Mm-hmm. And I think that people are maybe not responding to it because they're expecting one kind of movie and getting another one. Like, I don't think they were quite ready. They were wanting more gothic and less romance, you know, and they were expecting more kind of gut bucket phantasmagoria and less Mia Wasikowska going up and down hallways with a candelabra, which is why I love it.
That's why I loved it. What's wrong with that? If I could make a 5-minute trailer of just her walking around hallways, I'd love it.
Oh, hell yeah. I'd be first in line for that movie. It's set in the 1901, and we begin in Buffalo, where Mia Wasikowska is being raised by her widowed father, and she has aspirations toward being a writer, but her work tends to include ghosts because she was visited as a child by the ghost of her late mother, warning her to beware of Crimson Peak. And
the kid's like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, exactly.
Shut up, Mom.
She's been lifelong friends with a doctor played by Charlie Hunnam, who's clearly smitten with her, but she is soon swept off her feet by a visiting baronet played by Tom Hiddleston.
What's the difference between a baron and a
baronet? I have no idea.
All right.
Maybe a baronet is a smaller baron.
I guess. A baron with a crappy house.
Well, yeah, we're getting there. That's act two. Anyway, so Tom Hiddleston shows up in America with his sister, played by Jessica Chastain. They're trying to raise money for this giant device that he's built to dig more clay out of the dugout mines under his ancestral home in England. He winds up marrying Mia Wasikowska and whisking her off to England, taking her to the manor house, which is a horror unto itself. The floors bleed with red clay. There are holes in the ceiling, so it's always snowing in the living room. And
Jessica Chastain greets them, the sister, with the keys, and she says, some rooms in this place aren't safe. You're like, no rooms in this place are safe.
Including
whatever room you're in.
Yeah, especially. That's top of the list. So then, of course, you know, she is then cue the wandering around hallways in a puffy sleeve nightgown with a candelabra and discovering horrible, horrible secrets. This is super atmospheric and moody, and I kind of feel like it's funny. I've been listening to the show lately. I kind of feel like is my sort of verbal tic that I do a lot. I will try and stop saying it all the time.
Do you kind of feel like it?
I kind of feel like it is. It strikes me as a movie that is clearly an homage, but unlike so many other ones, it feels like it's not soulless. You know, I think he wanted to make a certain kind of movie, but he's not content to merely sort of recreate like shots that he loves or, right. you know, characters that he thought was cool in other movies. I think he really is telling a story and making a movie, but he's just making it in this idiom that he really digs.
Yeah. You called it, you know, like the horror version of Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Yes.
Bonnie Tyler video.
Edith Wharton plus Edgar Allan Poe plus Bonnie Tyler. Which was pointed out to me on Facebook, the Total Eclipse of the Heart video was directed by Russell Mulcahy.
And you're going to have to tell me who that is.
Man. He made Highlander.
Oh, okay.
Ah. He directed actually the pilot to the U.S. Queer as Folk. He's gay Canadian filmmaker. Yeah.
The
No straight man directed the Total Eclipse of the Heart. Let's face it.
You don't know.
Well, no, I know. Russell Mulcahy directed it.
You know what I mean. The level of puffy costuming.
And Botticelli hair.
And hair and production design and set decoration and ghost construction in the digital, you know, realm, and everything in the frame is just sumptuous and
tangible,
and you want to reach out and touch the spiky bits of the stairs
and the hallways and the velvet wallpaper or whatever molding, you know.
She wakes in the night in her feathery, sunken in bed, and she's wearing a night. I don't know what it is. It's like a night corset or something. And there's.
It's cold in that house.
Gigantic, puffy shoulders on the night corset, and the. Oh my God.
Yeah, the brocade budget on this movie must have been just off the charts.
How do they stay puffy when you sleep?
The performances are exactly the kind of. That was actually my question. Is there a between take? Like costume puffer who comes along and makes things billow.
They had a different kind of fluffer on this film.
The performances are so crazy. And I think if you walk away from this and you think, oh, well, that was just too over the top, then you have missed the point.
Everything is loony, but in an appropriate sort of way.
Jessica Chastain, in particular, as the villainess, I'm not going to give anything away, but
she's very Mrs. Danvers.
The way she serves people, 100%. The way she serves people tea and other foods is one of my favorite things in a movie all year long.
You've never heard a spoon scraping on
the
china.
The effect of the spoon when she's putting it in her mouth. I love that.
it's seriously like nails on a chalkboard.
Yeah.
When she does that. And I was never scared. It's not a horror movie. It's
an atmospheric.
It's a ghost story about. I can't tell you. It's a ghost story about people who want to do very bad things.
Yes.
And so I'm in love with it in the way that I was in love as a kid with all the Hammer films that would show on television.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of those Hammer movies was crazy, luridly colored and beautiful in kind of a cheap way.
Sure.
And it was, you know, the 19th century, but also 1968. So the women all had giant wigs and the like thick black eyeliner.
Right.
And again, they were never frightening. They were boring, actually. Right. And every one of the films was like, I dare say there's a ghost in this castle.
I think they get the pacing right in terms of spacing out the sort of boo moments, you know?
Yeah.
But I was never bored waiting for the next one. Like, there was enough other stuff to look at.
Oh, my God.
The characters were there to think about. As opposed to, and I keep citing this, the Godzilla remake, when I complained that it was super boring until the end of the monsters fight. And people were like, well, that's what the originals were like. It's like, well, maybe that's not the thing to emulate in your remake then. You know, like, give me something to care about until the monster fight. The writing and acting was so bad in that Godzilla movie that I was just bored out of my mind. But this one, they're true to the not being like, bam, bam, this, that, all the things, but but they make it worth sitting there while it's not happening, you know.
It's just grandiose and overwrought and gorgeous and silly and creepy and everything I wanted it to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I really felt like it totally delivered.
It's the kind of thing I would want to watch, like, every couple of years or once a year, like at Halloween season. It's just that got that mood dripping from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a pleasure working on
it. If I had
actual and I worked time. On that movie for a year.
Wow. So,
yeah.
Yeah, if I had actual time, that would be something I would go see again.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Now, and then, so you also went and saw Goosebumps, which is kind of the, if you're too young for Crimson Peak, right. This could be the movie for you.
I did not see Goosebumps.
Okay.
I chose just to blow it off and avoid it.
It's fun. I put it in the Ghost and Mr. Chicken, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, Frankenweenie category of, like, horror movies for kids.
I thought it was kind of like it reminded me of Jumanji.
Totally, yeah. I said it was Gremlins meets Jumanji when we did it on What the Flick.
Right, yes, but... I think it's fun and great for kids and family, but in the same way that Jumanji for me doesn't still resonate, mm-hmm. I feel like it's kind of disposable. And I went into it thinking, because I'm a little too old. I just missed being a horror fan. I missed the cusp of being young enough to read the books or enjoy the TV show. So when I went into it, I thought it seemed from just the marketing, a little bit of the marketing, just in terms of one sheets and even the font that the title is in, that it could be kind of this Tim Burton-y kind of a unique vision. Mm. And I kind of got kind of horror Jumanji, where it's fun, but I feel like, you know, in 3 years are people going to want to put it back on because it's so different. Like, Gremlins has a little bit of an attitude.
Well, sure, yeah, it's spikier and more anarchic. Well,
it's Joe Dante, so he's got a point of view. This is great and fun, serviceable, and, like, the dummy is great.
Yeah. Here's the thing. You don't see enough kids' movies, probably, because you don't have to.
Yeah.
This is a really good one.
I used to work on lots of kids' movies.
In terms of just the structure and the setup and the characters and all that stuff, much better than so much of the stuff that's being aimed at kids these days. So
I thought the setup was great. It took its time to establish the characters, I know they don't.
They
do
aren't
in
rushing
kids
into things.
Now.
Yeah. So the setup is that this kid, and his name has flown out of my head now. He was handsome boy from the No Good, Very Bad Day, whatever, that movie.
I feel like he could be Chris Hemsworth's, like, younger brother.
Kind of, yeah.
The way he speaks.
So he and his mom, Amy...
Baby Hemsworth.
Yeah.
That's what we'll call him from this point
Baby Hemsworth moves to town with his mom, Amy Ryan, who is the new vice principal of the school where he's going to be going. And next door, there is this cute girl who talks to him through the window, and then her... weird, very disciplinarian dad who tells the guy to stay away. The dad is Jack Black. Come to find out that Jack Black is playing R.L. Stine, the writer of all the Goosebumps books, who in this movie has become this recluse that no one knows where he is. And there's a bookshelf with all of these leather-bound editions of all the manuscripts of the Goosebumps books, and they're all locked. Come to find out, it's because the monsters are all real, that R.L. Stine summoned them when he was a lonely youth. And they were, you know, and he was a friendless kid. So he created these monsters and they became manifest. And so then, of course, through more complications, they all get loose. And so Baby Hemsworth and the girl and the dorky best friend and R.L. Stine have to, like, run around all over town to try and capture them all. And it's fun. It is very silly, but I had a good time.
No, it's fun. I definitely enjoyed myself for it too. And I think partway through, again being the horror fan, I was like, I just wanted to be a little bit more transgressive. But I totally appreciate, like, how much fun, and Jack Black is fun. Everybody is great, and the monsters are all great. There's a clown. I wish there was more clown.
I was thinking more clown too. Yes, but those lawn gnomes were a lot scarier than I thought.
Yes,
they were gonna be.
Yes,
a lot more creepy.
I mean, people were actually in jeopardy, which I appreciated.
Sure.
Is it PG-13 or just PG?
I think it might be straight up PG, but I'm not sure.
Right.
Chrissy Lemire said 8 and up.
8 and up.
So
yeah.
Wait, did she take little Nick?
She did not take Nick because of a scheduling conflict. Her take was 8 and up, and she's
so
got.
He wouldn't have had a good time.
Maybe.
And it's better than Jumanji. Like, I don't think Jumanji was that great. But it's definitely better than this.
I'll buy that. I haven't seen Jumanji in a long time, so I can't even really remember. But yeah, well, it's also weird, and I think the internet has really inflated this a lot. the stuff that people loved as children.
Yes.
Becomes part of the canon whether you want it to or not.
Right. Right.
Like, yeah. We're all too old for Hocus Pocus.
I worked on that.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So apparently if you were 8 when Hocus Pocus came out, you still
understand.
Think it's great. You know, and I mean, just random movies that will pop up, like Troop Beverly Hills, right. Or, you know, I mean, you could even make a case that Clue falls into that category,
yeah,
I think a lot of people.
Yeah.
It does.
But yeah, that's just like, yeah, I loved it when I was 8, and so I still think it's great. You know, and I don't know. I
have that problem probably with later 70s movies. Maybe. I do with slasher movies. I think Prom Night is awesome.
Oh, well, that is a problem. I like to think I take them on a case-by-case basis, but I don't know. I haven't. Well, no. I did go back and revisit the North Avenue Irregulars. And while not as funny as I remember it being.
When she breaks her nails.
The nails
the
are still great. Right. And, you know, I still love the fact that, you know, I was such a homo. Like, that I was a little kid. I was like, oh, a Disney movie with Karen Valentine and Barbara Harris? Yeah. I'm in.
It's a female cast, yeah. Right.
But, you know, people might think twice about, like, whether or not their childhood favorites merit,
well, yeah,
you
if
know.
You love something really hard as a child and you're in your 20s or 30s and you're still, you know, into it,
you know,
really
Generation
hard.
Goonies certainly went through this period.
Right.
You know?
Give that thing some extra scrutiny and then tell yourself, you know what? Yeah, okay, it sucks. Yeah,
or still just enjoy it, but don't make us all watch.
But I'm going to love it anyway.
Yeah, don't make us take it seriously.
Just don't write a think piece about how secretly it's incredible, because
for BuzzFeed.
It's not. It's not.
Yeah. It's just, it's a thing that was special to you.
Right.
Incidentally, speaking of Clue, I posted a link to this on our Linoleum Knife Facebook page. Gallery 1988 in Los Angeles is currently doing a Clue-themed show.
Oh, wow.
And they have some kind of cool artwork. And, I mean, I'm not going to go buy any of it, but it does remind me that I, for years, have always wondered.
If you wanted to. I wouldn't.
Begrudge it.
Begrudge you.
I'm sure the good stuff's already been snapped up anyway. But it occurred to me, how has nobody made a Clue edition with the movie cast on it? That just seems like a no-brainer.
It does to me.
Like, I would
too,
think that
yeah.
if Paramount still yeah. owns all those images and all those likenesses, right. Assuming that the actors signed them away at the time for whatever, come on.
It does make sense that they would have had a movie tie-in edition to the board game. Yeah. At the time of the film's release.
At the time of the film's release.
That's what I was thinking when it came out. I was like, why is there not a...
Well, I remember going version. I was in Nashville. I remember going to a Toys R Us to see if they had one. And not only did they not have one, they had completely sold out of Clue. So, like, if the movie had accomplished nothing else, it at least got people buying the game, you know.
So
in,
here's
in
what needs to happen. Some design nerd.
Yes, and probably has.
Needs to fabricate one.
Yeah.
Bootleg. You
know, yeah, bootleg version.
Well, the problem is there's no Wadsworth piece.
You make one.
But, I mean, there's not a space for him in the board. Like, he's not in
you
the game.
You make
games.
One.
Yeah, I guess you could do that.
Inventiveness.
He can share a side with Colonel Mustard.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that just seems to be that... is begging to happen. Okay, well, all right, let's hold on. Let's see. What's your list? What are we doing this week? What films are we covering?
Oh, are you trusting me to have the list?
I want to hear what you've got.
Crimson Peak.
Correct.
Goosebumps.
Yes.
Bridge of Spies.
Right.
Oh, you want me to keep going?
Yes.
Jane Bay par Agnès V.
Right.
The Assassin.
Mm-hmm.
Truth.
Mm-hmm.
Beasts of No Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the ones we didn't see that we got to catch up on, such as Room.
I want to see Room.
And Experimenter.
Right.
And Woodlawn.
Right.
And Kung Fu Master.
Mm.
And A Ballerina's Tale about Misty Copeland,
yes.
The first black woman named principal dancer for American Ballet Theater. And perhaps, I'm going to take Bibbs's review.
Uh-huh.
Whatever he says, I'll go do it. Dancing, It's On.
Oh, is that this week?
That's this week.
All right. Well, also, Sion Sono's Tokyo Tribe.
And Sean Sono's...
Tokyo Tribe.
Yeah.
And then I want to say there's something else.
Yakuza Apocalypse that we still haven't seen.
Right. But I'm trying to think. I think there's something else that's out this week that Christy and I reviewed on What the Flick that you don't have on that list.
Because a lot of movies this weekend, right?
Is yeah. Hang on. We did six movies on What the Flick. We did Pan and Steve Jobs from last week.
Yes.
And then we also did Crimson Peak, Bridge of Spies, Goosebumps, and...
you keep going. I'm going to look through your...
Something
I'm
else.
I'm
going to
scroll through your thing here.
All right.
See if you posted any of
those. I posted all of them.
I know, but
there's,
not...
I know. There's just too many... These are the fascinating conversations that we normally like to have off
mic. I'll get
mic.
To it. Off mic, on mic. Doesn't matter.
But this week, because I've been a fan of the show for 3.5 years.
Oh,
like, since,
thank you.
And this week when I was trying to figure out when I could schedule to see movies, I'm like, they see a lot of movies every week. Oh, my God.
Yep.
Just trying to fit them in.
This
There's
is our
picture
life.
Of Cafe Bustelo on your feed.
Because, yeah, I mean, you know, when people will ask us to go, like, have dinner over on a weeknight, it's kind of like... We'll probably have a right. screening.
Something,
that's
something.
Work time
Angela
for you.
Angela Lansbury.
Hey, she turned 90 this week.
Yep, she sure
Attention
did.
Must be paid. Dame Angela Lansbury.
No, Alonzo, this is basically everything.
That can't be... I swear there's something we're leaving out.
I don't know. Nothing on the Box Office Mojo list that... that I got.
Hmm. Okay. Well, we'll go with it then. I'll just tell you later if you missed something. So, Bridge of Spies. Did you see
it? I didn't get to see it.
It's Spielberg's latest, and it's about a...
Story.
Yeah, true story about an American lawyer.
Last name Donovan.
James Donovan. Played by Tom Hanks, who was an insurance lawyer, but years earlier, this is in the 1950s, he had previously been a prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials. A Soviet spy named Rudolf Abel, played by Mark Rylance, is captured, and they want to give... It's not so much that they want him to have a fair trial as they want to give the appearance that he had a fair trial. And so Tom Hanks is selected to represent him in court.
Close enough.
So Tom Hanks decides to actually defend him. And despite the fact that he is constantly having things thrown in his way by the judge, like he doesn't get the extra time he needs and all this other stuff, clearly his client is being railroaded. And ultimately, you know, his efforts are for naught. He is convicted. The one thing he does manage to do is to convince the judge not to execute him. The thought being that, you know, the Cold War is raging and they're doing stuff to us and we're doing stuff to them. And at some point, one of our guys over there might get captured and we might need to trade.
It's a rager of a Cold War out there. Go on.
What?
So the Cold War was raging.
Yeah.
So it was a rager.
Oh, shut up. As it turns out, he was right. And not long after that, the whole Francis Gary Powers incident happens, and we do indeed need someone to trade. And so Hanks is sent to East Berlin to negotiate a swap with no... the government really is pretending like they're not involved and they can't help him if anything goes wrong or whatever, but they're like, you go do this. And but we're just going to pretend like we had nothing to do with it. And so then it winds up they have captured a second American, so he's trying to get them both out, and it's this kind of like...
A student,
so it's this whole sort of face-off with, you know, who will give what and when and how and negotiating, and...
He's on his own.
Yeah.
He has to go do this by himself with no official... support.
Right.
They're over there with him, but he has to go alone.
Officially, they're disavowing all knowledge, whatever. So I really, really like the first half of this movie, which is the Rudolf Abel trial stuff. I felt like it was a smarter look at the War on Terror than we've seen in a lot of other movies that have attempted either directly or metaphorically talk about... People get afraid, and then they start throwing constitutionality out the window because, the big bad fill in the blank, you know.
That's really the point of the movie. What kind of people are we if we only believe what we believe when we're not panicked?
Right. So all that stuff I thought was really fascinating. And Mark Rylance is really good.
Yeah.
He's very cagey. You don't really quite know what he's doing. And he's very droll. I liked him a lot. And then... Once Tom Hanks goes to East Berlin, it feels a little more kind of a routine espionage-y spy stuff movie. And then it takes a left turn into Spielberg country in a way that really bugged me. But you were more into it than me.
I liked it a lot more than you did. The first sequence, pardon me, the opening sequence is fantastic. Hmm. Where they're sort of chasing Rudolph Abel. I like the next third about the trial, and do you have to go somewhere?
No, go ahead. I'm just going over here. Maintain the illusion.
I like the next third, which is about, you know, the trial, and I really like the swap, you know, half of the film where he has to go off and be his own. His only support is himself. Whatever involvement the Coen brothers had on the script, you said it was just a polish, but
They were the second ones on it.
That makes me want to see it a little
bit
more.
If it was just a polish, I like their polish because they managed to sort of dig out the weird idiosyncrasies of human behavior, and I really love how they accomplish that.
Well, let's not forget, they also did a polish on Unbroken, and you really can't see their stamp on that movie anywhere.
Well, we're not talking about Unbroken, are we?
I'm just saying, I didn't get a ton of Coen out of this movie, but I think you're just saying, I like this movie and I like the Coen brothers, so I think the Coen brothers must have done something.
I think you should go shh. Okay, fine. Right now. I'm talking right now.
Do go on, Dave White.
It's fun to see this in person.
I really feel that's there in the more sort of deadpan comedic elements that take place during that second half. And yes, you are right. At the end, Spielberg does the thing that he has been doing far too often for both my and your taste in recent years. He piles it on. He piles it on, hammers home the meaning more times than is necessary. I don't think it's actually ever necessary. If you've told your story well enough, you don't have to explain the film.
Yeah, it's very...
He likes to explain the film at the end these days, and he likes to do it more than once. And that bugs me. But this movie does, period, really well. It builds suspense because, you know what? I didn't know this story was a true story before I saw it. I've never heard this story before.
So even the name Francis Gary Powers did not?
Nope.
Okay.
Me neither.
Nope. So I didn't know how it was going to end.
There was a TV movie about him with Lee Majors, people. Come on. You have no excuse.
I was probably doing something very important.
I don't doubt
when that TV movie aired.
Curling up with your pet rock.
Anyway. What year did it come out? That might be the case.
It was during the 70s. I mean.
All right. Well, it might have been, if it was 1975, that might have been me and my Pet Rocks special moment. I was 10 years old. I won a Pet Rock from the local radio station. They were giving them away to children. I got one.
Google Pet Rock, kids, if you don't know what that is.
It's a dumb thing that happened in the 70s that little kids thought was great.
And made a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, where was I before you?
It was suspenseful because you didn't know it was a true story.
Before you became a disruptor.
You didn't mind the piling on of the...
Oh, no, I do.
Oh,
mind
you did
it.
Mind that.
I do.
No,
mind
you
it.
Found it suspenseful because you weren't aware that these
but
I'm how
willing
it all turned
to,
out.
But I'm willing to just... No, look, ten minutes before the movie's over, leave.
It is.
Did you get it?
Yeah. I will acknowledge it is quite suspenseful. And even if, and so I'd say it passes the Apollo 13 test. Like, yeah. I knew what happened, and I was still sort of like, you know.
And
it's very skillfully done. I mean, Spielberg's not a hack, but I when he goes to that place, I'm like,
that populist kind of.
That Ron Howard area, I just like, stop it.
Handsomely mounted production.
Very much so. The period stuff felt very
Tom
true.
Tom Hanks. At this point,
is Jimmy Stewart.
In Tom Hanks' career, it's almost cheating to cast him in a movie. Because what you're actually saying is, without him having to even give much of a performance, even though he does in this film,
is trust this man.
He right. carries the weight of being, you know, he's America's dad. And that's his role now in the culture. And And not only do you like him on film, you know, all reports of him in real life are that he's just as nice and cool in life. And so you instantly, there's a reason that sorceress, Carly Rae Jepsen, the woman who made me fall down, put him in her video to sing the song instead of her.
Right.
So that we would all love
him. Because who doesn't like Tom Hanks?
Who doesn't want to see Tom Hanks lip sync the Carly Rae Jepsen song in her music video? Ain't nobody don't want to see that.
True.
So.
One thing that really bugged me on a script level here was.
So that.
They go out of their way to introduce Billy Magnussen, who we've been calling Butters for years. Because he's such a blonde moppet. As Tom Hanks's like legal associate, and then there's this funny dinner scene.
No offense, Billy Magnussen.
No, we think you're just swell. You were hilarious and into
friends
the woods.
Friends of friends wind up telling you they heard this. We think you're great.
Yes. Anyways, they set him up as Tom Hanks's legal associate. There's a whole funny dinner scene where clearly he and Tom Hanks's daughter are having a relationship behind Tom Hanks's back, and it's all very charming and stuff. And then it's never mentioned again, and those characters don't pop up again. I was like, why did we spend time setting this up and then just poof? You know, it just seemed like a weird choice. Like either there should have been some resolution to it or just cut it out entirely.
I think they did cut it out almost entirely. And we were just left with the bits,
I guess.
Maybe there was some piece of information in that scene that they couldn't
sacrifice. Maybe
those,
so.
Those
yeah.
little firsty bits, you know.
But yeah, so it's. I mean, it's certainly worth seeing. There's a lot to like about Bridge of Spies. I wish it had been better. And it bothers me when filmmakers don't trust their audience in that way. I mean, I still think about...
Or the money people.
Someone's not trusting. Yeah. Spielberg seems like he doesn't get pushed around.
Right.
He's doing it because he wants to do it. I mean, I remember like Frost Nixon, the reason I mentioned Ron Howard. Yeah. That was a movie where they would have Sam Rockwell saying things like tell you what just happened in case you missed it somehow, you know? Or...
Ron Howard's over, I think that's one of his best.
Oh,
was Frost Nixon, really?
I like Rush a lot.
I didn't see Rush.
Rush is great. Yeah. You won't believe it's a Ron Howard movie.
Right.
It's that good.
Rush is really good.
But the one that always kills me was remember Road to Perdition, another Tom Hanks movie. There's a scene.
Was that Alan Ball?
He might have written it. It was Sam Mendes.
Right.
So. There's a scene where Paul Newman, who's like big mobster guy, is sitting at a piano and he's Tom Hanks sits next to him and they start duetting. And it's this scene. And then you cut to Daniel Craig at the other side of the room glowering because Daniel Craig is Paul Newman's son and resents the fact that Tom Hanks has always been closer to him, you know, as this outsider than he has. And that's all communicated visually in that shot. And then somebody says... Oh, he hates it because he's taken his father's role and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, shut up, movie. I know. We all got it.
And it might have been off camera and it was just an ADR that they added later.
I don't think it was, actually. But yeah, that you could totally do that. That makes me nuts. And that's
when
why.
When they don't trust the audience.
Yes,
yeah,
you know, that's why I like so much about, you know, I mean, not about all European films, but the ones that we get here in the sort of art house context, you know, you have to be paying attention and you have to catch that stuff.
Right.
And it's all there and they don't stop and make sure that the back balcony picked up on the fact that, you know, oh, he put the letter in his pocket, you know, or whatever. Right. So, yeah, it drives me nuts.
Yeah, agreed.
Speaking of movies you have to pay attention to.
Ah, The Assassin.
The Assassin. The latest from Hou Hsiao-hsien.
Yes. My first... Hou Hsiao-hsien movie. Dave's a big fan. He is a Taiwanese filmmaker who specializes in long takes and people not saying anything.
So the same guy who did the tram one?
Oh, Monica Mana. That was a documentary with long takes of people not saying anything.
This is the latest from Hou Hsiao-hsien. He won the Best Director Award at Cannes. For this.
It's Taiwan's Oscar entry this year.
I'm wondering how that's going to pan out.
What will the Academy Foreign Language voters make of this film?
Well, the Academy Foreign Language voters...
Are they down for that kind of thing? Or are they down for sort of like the, you know...
The Academy Language Foreign Language voters used to be like the really old people who had nothing better to do and would have to come to like a ton of screenings.
Yeah.
And their tastes, their choices tended to be more middle of the road.
Yeah.
And that's one of the ones that they've shaken up recently. And like they have panels who see like a chunk of the films... I don't know, might have a fighting chance.
So this stars Shu Qi, who has been in a couple of other films by Ho.
Millennium Mambo.
I think she was in Three Times. And Chang Shen, who has also been in a few films by Ho. She plays the assassin.
Yes.
She was sent to Assassin Academy with her, run by her aunt, who is a nun
princess
and a princess, and she
look for that outfit at the Disney store.
She comes back from assassin school, and the nun princess aunt says, "Okay, you're gonna go murder the governor of the Weibo province." Now, the Weibo province has been fighting against the sort of imperial...
Chinese state army. Or
yeah.
Whatever. This is like, what, 9th century?
The 9th century, yeah. And an assassin, her name is Nian Yang. She says...
Don't wanna. Oh, sorry.
That's what she says.
I forgot. She looks at the
floor. Don't put words in her mouth.
No, yes. No one else did.
She, as a response, she looked at the floor.
Yes.
In a Ho Xiao Shen movie, that means conflict. Internal conflict is happening. She goes anyway. And she skulks about. She has opportunities to do the thing, but instead she sort of insinuates herself into other machinations. Like this.
You're just trying to make more dead air spaces on this show by quoting Ho Xiao Shen.
I'm trying to recreate the atmosphere of a Ho Xiao Shen film.
Yes, in his movie, you do not hear the fan in the background.
When you pause, exactly. I often think my phone is going to ring in my car when I listen to your podcast.
That's like, I know. That's why I keep...
Dave often pauses a certain way, and I'm like, is my phone about to ring?
People think they're either being disconnected or...
Cutting off my Bluetooth.
So stop doing that, Dave White.
You know what? I can't be tamed.
You will not stop rocking, Mr. Gorbachev.
I will not stop rocking. This is a film about hesitancy. It is a film about conflicted feelings and thwarted action and the residual effects of other actions. When we were on Press Play this week, this Friday with Madeline Brand on KCRW, I said, imagine a bell has been rung, but all you get to hear is the reverberation. That's kind of a Hu Xiaoshen movie for me. This is a film about, like I told her, this is about inability as much as it is about ability. It's about inaction as much as it is about action. There are action sequences in the film. There are martial arts sequences in the films. They are incredibly economical. They are not flamboyant. They are not, you know, flourishes.
Landing on the top of bamboo trees, you know, with wire work.
This is not Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. No. When she goes to kill someone, she's got this sort of medium-sized knife, and she makes quick work of that person.
Yeah.
The end. You're dead. And then she retreats.
So yeah, the fact that this movie is called The Assassin, and it's even being distributed in the U.S. by a company called Wellgo USA, who mostly...
Street noise is more noise than you'll hear from most of the films.
Who mostly distribute more kind of traditionally action-y Asian films, you know. This is not that.
Are they selling it? Have you seen the trailer?
No, I have not.
I have seen the trailer. The trailer does include some of those sequences, right. But they're also... I think they're not trying to like fool you into thinking right. this is going to be like a Jet Li movie or something.
This is an abstraction of a martial arts film. Yeah. And it is, for those of you who know that you like this sort of thing, this is capital A art film.
Yes.
This is impeccably organized, meticulously structured. Every frame is the most beautiful thing you have seen in a movie theater all summer, all year.
It's gorgeous.
It's
shot by Mark Lee Ping Bing.
Mark Lee Ping Bing, and he has been working with Ho for over 30 years.
He also shot In the Mood for Love.
He also shot In the Mood for Love, if that tells you anything. Yeah.
And Norwegian Wood. So
I just went to the Academy this week, and our friend John Powers, who's the film critic for Vogue magazine, he was on stage talking to Mr. Ho and Mr. Lee, and they had all kinds of funny stuff to say. Uncharacteristically funny, both of these guys. You would think they would be very serious.
Yeah.
And every time John would ask Ho Xiaoshan a question, he'd look at him and sort of shrug and go, And, you know, there was this translator on stage working overtime. And they finally get to, at one point, John says, "You have to have thought about these things before." And Mark Lee Ping Bin says, "If you think this is inarticulate, you should be me and have to speak to him every single day," which is, I think, is really wonderful because it really, it's sort of in keeping with my own ideas about people who are truly visionary. They can't always just explain it to you. They can't always tell you why they've chosen to do something the way they've chosen to do it. They can't always tell you, "Well, I left this intentionally ambiguous because that's how I see the world."
Right.
But their choices are what really tell you what they're about.
Right. But a lot of times as a creative, I think some of that stuff just becomes autonomic, and you can't even break down how you got from A to B. You just knew that B was where it happened.
Well, it's better not to know, I think, for the creative people. Like, if they know why they're doing it, sometimes it takes the mystery out. And,
I can see that.
This is another incredible film from Ho Xiaoshan. I've seen lots of his movies over the years. I remember moving to Los Angeles with you and finally having the opportunity to see his films.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though we had a couple art house theaters in Dallas, they still didn't show his movies.
No.
They showed, you know, the Merchant Ivory films and stuff like that. And so, what's up, helicopter? And so coming here and finally being, you know, the whole field open to you. You can see everything by anybody. And I remember very distinctly, LACMA did a retrospective of his films, and they were showing A Time to Live and A Time to Die. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited because I had never gotten a chance to see one of his movies. I had only read about him. And it was a Saturday night, and I was like, "Let's go see the 2.5 to almost 3 hour A Time to Live and A Time to Die, Ho Xiaoshan." And you said, "I don't know. Seems like it might be like homework."
I'd probably had a long week.
And that became the ongoing back and forth between you and me on films like that over the next 16 years.
Yes, I did see this one. This was my first Ho Xiaoshan film. I see what it is that you like about him, and I see what it is.
I'm so excited to show you more of his films now. It's going to be so great.
I see why he's important and why he does what he does well. I just don't know that I respond all that much to what he does.
You will. Under my guiding...
You are not the boss of me.
My guiding influence is going to make you love him.
Mm-hmm.
You will.
Yeah.
This is the beginning of a glorious adventure for you.
Uh-huh. And vegetables, too, I suppose.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. What else opened this week?
Two that you saw that I did not. Truth and Beasts of No Nation. Go.
Okay. Truth. Truth is about the Dan Rather.
You don't
Rather.
Need to say anything else. With
yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's funny.
What's garbage you to it, me?
Well, this now goes on my list of...
Who made it?
It's written and directed by a guy named James Vanderbilt, who wrote the two amazing Spider-Mans and White House Down, which I actually liked. And, you know, this is going on my list of whenever somebody tries to say that, oh, the reason I didn't like, you know, the Atlas Shrugged trilogy or something is because of my obvious leftist bias. Here's a movie that has a total leftist bias, and it's still bad. I agree with what this movie is saying, but boy, I did not want to listen to it say it anymore. It's about the whole Dan Rather investigation of George W. Bush's service in the Air National Guard, or lack thereof, and how that all then unraveled and was a big scandal at CBS and forced Rather to step down and all that stuff. And the movie does a good job, I think, of keeping up with, like, it throws a lot of data at you in terms of who the sources are and the timeline and da da da. Like, it's a complicated story. You know, the people reporting it are constantly having to sort of stop and piece it together themselves, and that allows you to sort of keep up with what's going on. But at the same time, it's so ham-fistedly written that every other scene there's some speech about how important journalism is and how you have to be able to ask the question. We need to ask the questions, you know. And it just gets so overwrought after a while. And the thing is, Spotlight has the same thing to say and says it much more skillfully and gracefully and compellingly. And that'll be opening in a couple of weeks. I'm very excited for you to see it. This one stars Cate Blanchett, who's never not good. Oh, you know, she plays Mary Mapes, the 60 Minutes producer, and she's pouring herself into it, and she creates a character, certainly, but the dialogue, again, is terrible. Robert Redford is Dan Rather. And
I didn't know that.
And it's a weird thing, because...
That's really strange.
He does a little bit of the Texas twang that Rather has. You can kind of hear it in his voice. In certain intonations, he'll sort of do the Rather thing. But he doesn't do anything to his hair. So you're watching one celebrity portraying another celebrity.
That's the weird thing.
But he looks like the celebrity that he is. So
looking a heck of a lot like Bob Redford.
Yeah, so there's not a second that you're looking at him and not thinking, well, hey, Robert Redford, what are you doing here? Oh, you're Dan. Oh, sorry. Dan. Everybody called him Dan. You're Dan Rather. You know, never convincingly not Robert Redford. He is, you know, is Dan Rather.
Shh, shh, shh. He wants to be called Dan.
Call him Dan Rather.
Just go with it. Go with it.
So that's it. That's irritating. And it's just very preachy and overdone, and which is too bad, because they're telling an interesting story. The one way they drop the ball in terms of keeping track of people is that there are these CBS executives, two in particular, who are played by actresses who look way too much alike. One of them is like a CBS news person, and the other one's like the vice president of primetime or whatever. And I could never tell who was who. And then there's this other guy who's a 60 Minutes producer, who, it's a reminder of why it's so important to cast character actors that have really memorable faces, so that, you know, you're introduced to them once and then the rest of them are like, oh yeah, him. This guy just blended into the woodwork. And so every time he would pop up, like, who are you again? Oh, you're the guy I can't remember. So you must be the 60 Minutes guy. Yeah, it's not good, unfortunately. Elizabeth Moss gets nothing to do.
Oh, she's in it?
She's in it.
See, that would make me want to...
She gets zero to do.
I really do like her a lot.
Dennis Quaid and Topher Grace get a little to do. Topher Grace gets saddled with one of the big speeches about corporate media, blah, 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 blah. Again, I'm not disagreeing with anything this movie has to say, but it's just not saying it very well or interestingly.
And it's even sadder when we're at that political bent and it's not a good movie either. It's like twice as disappointing as a bad right-wing
movie. You want to support it and be like, yes, go see this movie and learn some stuff.
And it's
you know?
Smart. It's made by smart people.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Then there's Beast of No Nation, which is quite good, very powerful. It's premiering on Netflix, so if you are in the United States and you are a Netflix subscriber, you can already be watching it. Did you get a chance to check it out?
No, I did not.
Okay. It stars... It doesn't really star Idris Elba. He is plays a very dynamic supporting role. It stars a kid named Abraham... something? Can you look it up real quick for me?
Okay.
He's like 11. He won an award at Venice as like emerging talent, and he's extraordinary. I mean, like, he pretty much is literally carrying this movie. It's based on a novel. It's about a young boy growing up in an African country, and there's a revolution.
Abraham Atta,
that's right. And his family dies, and he sort of runs into... the jungle, I guess, to try and save himself, and winds up getting dragooned into a platoon of child soldiers that's being led by Idris Elba as the commandant. And it's about the process by which this kid transforms from being this sort of sweet, loving child to being this dead-eyed assassin. And it's gripping and horrifying and not completely without hope, but it definitely doesn't sugarcoat, you know, the horrors of it all. It's directed by Cory Fukunaga, who did the first season of True Detective, and he did Sin Nombre and Jane Eyre.
Yeah,
it's really fascinating, and yes, it's not the bummer you expect it to be, but it's not so depressing that you can't get through.
That's what I thought it was going to be. Like, super heavy.
No, it's...
I would love.
Sure, no, yeah. It's... I'll say it's measured. You know, it doesn't deprive you of those horrors, but it doesn't dump them on you with such regularity that you just have to turn it off and go take a shower, you know? I saw it at Venice, and I thought it was really powerful, and I have no idea... if the Netflix audience wants to see it. I mean, my impression of Netflix in a lot of ways, I mean, not so much for their original programming, obviously, but...
you watch it when it's time to chill.
Exactly. People are chilling with Netflix, even when that's not a euphemism. You know?
House of Cards, I guess David Fincher, when it first came on, a little bit.
That's true. Yeah, right. that was grittier than usual.
I think
usual.
They're trying to figure out what their audience is.
For example, probably. The reason that Netflix signed a deal with Adam Sandler... it's because Adam Sandler movies do really well on Netflix, which to me says people are looking for something they don't have to think about.
Right.
And so, anything by Adam Sandler. So I don't know. I mean, I hope there's an audience for this kind of stuff. It's great that they're supporting it. And, you know, of course, it's the thing we always deal with whenever movie theaters feel like their traditional form of you know, distribution is being threatened. Like, I think it's... this movie is open. It did open in theaters, but good luck finding one, because I'm sure a lot of theaters are like, you want us to open a movie that's all but simultaneously premiering on Netflix? No thanks.
Right.
A lot of the big chains aren't showing it. But I don't think it's going to diminish that much on the small screen. You could watch it at home and it would be just as good. So yeah, I would say definitely people should check it out. And Elba's performance is great.
Can you tell it's the same director as True Detective Season 1? Does it have that kind of... I mean, has it come through? That's what sells me. Like, I'm interested in his work.
So, I mean,
he was supposed to do the adaptation of It.
Oh, interesting.
Not anymore.
There is one segment that's kind of a long take with a lot of stuff happening, sort of like the end of episode 4, I think, with all the backyards and everything. There's one moment that's kind of like, hey, check it out, you know. I would have to watch both of them again to kind of draw more. Right. To connect more dots, but he has a sure hand, I think, and he's a good storyteller,
and the acting is
really strong, and I think he is able to kind of unflinchingly look at disturbing material and render it in a way that it is still dramatically interesting and draws you in. Is that it? That's all this week?
Do you know what a Lancashire hot pot is?
Tell me, please.
Jane B.
Right. Jane B knows.
It's lamb. The first ingredient in this recipe,
salt,
is drippings.
Ooh! Thank you, Britain.
Lamb cut into large chunks.
Mm-hmm.
Lamb kidneys.
Ooh.
Yeah. Bunch of onions. Potatoes. This is one of the three recipes that Jane Birkin knows how to make. So it's kind of like you and meatloaf.
Part of a limited repertoire, but beloved nonetheless.
1988 documentary about Jane Birkin from Agnes Varda called Jane Bay par Agnes V.
Yes. Which is opening in the United States for the first time.
In one city.
Yes, in New York at Lincoln Plaza. They are screening two films from Agnes Varda that Varda has recently restored into 2K. One is Kung Fu Master, which stars Jane Birkin as a middle-aged woman who falls in love with a precocious teenager, played by Mathieu Demy, Agnes Varda's son with Jacques Demy. That's a reissue. That film did actually open in the States back in the day.
Yeah.
But Jane Bay par Agnes V is a U.S. premiere. So it is, for our shores, a new documentary.
It opened in France in 1988.
Yeah. And it's cool that Varda is going back and restoring her own stuff, because she spent a lot of time preserving the work of her late husband. You know, we have these amazing Blu-rays now from Criterion of these Jacques Demy films, thanks to her efforts.
Young Girls of Rochefort.
Yes, Umbrellas of Cherbourg, Donkey Skin, Lola, all that stuff. But, you know, she is an important filmmaker in her own right. I mean, she and Godard are pretty much...
Cleo from 5 to 7.
Cleo from 5 to 7. Yeah. She and Godard are the only living...
Vagabond.
Are the only living new wave filmmakers at this point, right?
Is
anybody else left? Rivette, Resnais.
They all died.
Yeah.
Truffaut,
Romer.
Yeah.
She might be. Yeah. So she is very important. And it continues.
Who are we missing?
Becker, I don't know.
Matt Severson, who are we missing?
Exactly, he'll know. And in her 90s, continuing to be a really vital filmmaking force. I mean, The Beaches of Agnes from a couple years ago was a great documentary. It was great.
The Gleaners and I is one of my
favorite
films of the past 15, 16 years.
Yeah, so she's... You know, so I'm glad that she is taking care of her own stuff as well as Demi's. So yeah, so Jane Bay par Agnes V, we just saw for the first time.
Will it?
Me too.
Play? Will it play around the country? Maybe, we hope.
I hope. I mean, I could see it might be the sort of thing where like it gets sort of one night museum gigs, or like if you have a local Alliance Française or something, they'll bring it in. I hope it gets a theatrical date in L.A.
So this is Agnes Varda really turning the camera on Jane Birkin in a way that makes Jane Birkin somewhat uncomfortable. Like, it begins with her saying, like, well, I don't want to look at the camera. And Agnes Varda's like, you must look at the camera or you're not looking at me.
and occasionally in the film you will see Varda behind the camera, you know, within her own movie.
Here is...
Hang on, before you get there, Bill, did you know who any of these people were before you saw
this movie? No idea. I got the screener, and I had no clue going in, so I started it, and 5 minutes in, I was like, I don't know what's going on. I was like, okay, I have to find out who Jane Birkin is. So I went to Wikipedia. I didn't
want to
read
to Hermes, and he asked for their most expensive purse.
But she, you know, she had a song, like, in the 60s that was famous. She was an actress, too.
Yeah.
So and then that's all I wanted to know. I was like, okay, if I know at least that, then
I can go from there.
I can go from. But at first, I was like, I had no kind of clue what the kind of background was.
She was one of the great it girls of the 60s. Yeah. Oh. She was a model.
Yeah.
She appeared nude in the movie Blow Up, which was a big scandal. She went to France. She married Serge Gainsbourg, who was, you know, the hot screenwriter, songwriter of the moment. They recorded a very salacious and still controversial duet. Yeah. Je t'aime moi non plus. They had Charlotte together.
Charlotte Gainsbourg. That was my in.
That was your takeaway.
Oh, right. The Antichrist star.
Her other daughter.
Right. Yeah. Who's also a model. And she has remained an actress. Did you ever see Evil Under the Sun?
A long time ago. I don't remember her from.
Okay. She's part of that ensemble. And the Birkin bag is named for her.
And she is unbelievably charming. I didn't know anything about her.
Oh, yeah.
And you walk away from this movie and just kind of love her.
The opening scenes of her just sort of trotting through scenery, you're like, hello, I'm Jane Birkin and I own France. Like, it's that's how charismatic and perfect she is.
She really is.
And she has recently started yelling at Hermes to take her name off the purse because she doesn't want to be associated with...
Crocodile cruelty.
With, cruelty, yeah.
And apparently, I did see in her Wikipedia page that she's been a very vocal advocate for Burmese independence.
Really?
Yeah. Mm.
So this, I really love this just because I love Anya Sparta and I love Jane Birkin, but things that made me love her more in this, she has the balls to look at the camera and say, I like being loved and being popular.
Yeah.
I'm happy. Like, I'm happy when people are paying attention to me. What celebrity says that out loud?
Right.
They all think it.
Mm-hmm. Right, there's a reason that all they human went beings, you know, and did that and auditioned. And, yeah. You know.
Now they're all, but they, you know, they hide behind their sunglasses. Like, oh, don't look, don't look, 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 don't look, don't look, look.
And it's not just celebrities, all human beings.
Sure.
Right. You're like, I like being loved. I want approval. I want everyone to like me. Right. You know, the other perfect thing about her is that she has a taxidermied.
Paris sewer rat
on her piano. Also a duck, but it's really the sewer rat.
Yeah,
that's the prize. She even said, she goes, they're so rare. Like, well, yeah, of course they're rare. Who wants that?
They're in the sewer.
But see, now that I know Jane Birkin has one, I'm now like, you want yeah, one. Of course I want one of those.
And it seems really charming, the way she says it and introduces it.
Maybe Hermes should start carrying them now and charging like $500 a pop.
Oh, that's funny. That you would think you could buy something for $500.
Sorry, $5,000.
You can get them at Necromance, I bet.
Oh, that's true. Maybe.
You might be able to get them at Necromance.
Two-headed chickens.
I know every Christmas they sell little taxidermied white mice as tree ornaments at Necromance.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And why don't we have one?
Right. Listeners.
I don't know why we don't have one. You probably have 20 by Christmas. I don't know that I... Like, I've gone back and forth with the idea of that.
I always thought you wanted a taxidermied kitten.
I do, but at the same time, I don't. We have so many...
You do have to kind of decorate your apartment around that.
Right. We have so many veggie and vegan friends.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
That, like, every time I go sit on a leather couch, I think, wow, this is so great. Like, I want one of these. Mm. Or a leather armchair, a real old one that's been broken in.
Oh, yeah.
I think, man, do I want one of these? And then I think, Doug and John would come over and be really angry.
But perhaps the taxidermy things died of natural causes. And that's just a way to preserve their beauty.
Maybe they did.
Possibly.
Maybe they did, but it's still...
They lived a full life.
Yeah,
perhaps.
I don't know. Like, aesthetically, yes, this all appeals to me. I eat meat. I don't care. Like, it's not a thing to me. But I, again, it goes back to, I want my friends to like me.
Fair enough.
And I want them to come over and not be like, why is there a dead animal staring at me?
Right. From the Christmas tree.
From the Christmas tree. From the, you know what I mean?
Like, sure. Okay.
So what I like are the little, bird ornaments that go on the tree that tie on wires to the tree, like they're little birds sitting on the branches.
But they're fake.
We've got like half a dozen of those.
Yeah.
But they're fake, yeah. And so that's kind of my thing. Mm. I did buy that little black crow, fake black crow ornament from Necromance years and years and years ago. Okay. We've had that for, yeah, like that's a, I don't know. That's about as far as I think I can go.
Are you a big Christmas person, Bill? Or?
I love, not like you, but I love Christmas. I love the holidays. Right. Yeah, yeah. But I have a Christmas tree.
Okay.
We have a Christmas
tree. You married a Jew. I didn't know. Which some people...
We have a white Christmas tree with blue balls.
Nice.
You're an atheist, so what do you...
Well, I'm just saying. Everybody handles it differently. I just was curious. Well, because one of the things that I like about the Krampus trailer, bringing it back to that, is that how it really kind of ties it in as a Christmas movie before then going dark.
Right, yes.
That's, I think, a very shrewd move.
How many minutes are we at right now?
It doesn't matter.
Tell me.
I'm not.
Tell me.
No.
90? We've hit 90 already, ish. Haven't we?
All right, almost to Palm Springs.
Let's get it.
I want to say about Jane B is that I thought that movie was completely unique. I've never seen a documentary quite like it. I mean, I'm not as versed as you guys in that stuff, but it's just so it's not like a normal kind of exposé of an actress.
No.
And all the shots where she seems to be speaking extemporaneously and off the cuff, I think might be rehearsed because there's camera moves and dollies and it's beautiful to look at. And then there's these interstitials where she acts out scenes. There's one thing with Laurel and Hardy where she plays Laurel.
Yes.
I didn't know where it was going. I don't exactly know exactly what it all meant.
The scene where she's the old woman scattering her husband's ashes in the vineyard. You know?
I've never seen a documentary like that, and I thought it was really... It could be work, but it's not, and it could be its own self-parody. It's so, you know...
Self-aware
and self-absorbed, but it a few degrees off, it would be like eye-rolling, but it's not. It's just really charming.
The subject and director are both so charming.
Yes.
Well,
I didn't realize it. Yeah. Like, I finished, I was like, I think I love it. I'm not sure. And then I slept on it and I woke up. I was like, hey, I can't stop thinking about it. I really love that movie. Thank you for telling me to watch it.
Well, I'm glad you bring up the fact that it's self-aware and stuff, because I think now, lately, I feel like there are so many documentaries that get made, about, especially documentaries about famous people that are clearly made, if the project wasn't begun by the famous person, the famous person seems to have a certain level of control.
Right.
And a certain level of the person making it doesn't want to lose their access.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you get these films that purport to be, subjective or objective, but they're kind of fawning and they're kind of like chummy and inside.
It's Beyonce making a movie about Beyonce.
For instance, there's
a lot of fan documentaries. Like, there's a movie, this guy, Dick Miller, the actor Dick Miller, who's on those Joe Dante movies. Like, it just becomes just almost fan appreciation without seeing any of the cracks.
So this movie at least felt like, from the very get-go, you know, these two women know each other. They like each other. This is not going to be... You know, she's not ripping the lid off Jane Birkin. This is them having fun and her kind of capturing the essence of this other woman that she finds so fascinating in a very specific way that may or may not always be kind of journalistic or whatever.
Right.
I think it's a really interesting way to approach a person who is an icon.
Sure.
And that is what she is in France, even though she's not French.
And then what the ideas about her iconography or what she stands for means to this filmmaker about stuff, about life, I think.
So, if you're in New York, go see it. And if you are not, keep an eye out for it. It will ideally be coming to you. And when it comes out on DVD, we'll tell you about that, too.
All right, DVD recommendations. Here are the Ho Xiao Shen films that you can get.
Okay.
Three Times.
Mm-hmm.
Millennium Mambo.
Uh-huh.
Café Lumière.
Is
Flight of the Red Balloon.
Is Café Lumière all him, or is it like an anthology?
That's all him.
Okay.
Wait. No, I'm sorry. It's an anthology. I'm sorry. I'm stupid. The other ones are difficult to find. However, some of them are on YouTube.
All right. Well, you can figure that out on
English
your
own. With English subtitles, specifically 1990s City of Sadness is on YouTube. With English subtitles, right now, ready to be watched. By any means necessary, get yourself to one of his movies. Some are out there, easy to be found. Some are free to be found on YouTube.
Fair enough.
And you can start anywhere. You'll thank me for this.
All right. My DVD pick is a film that came out earlier this year that I did not see and wish I had, called I'll See You in My Dreams. It stars Blythe Danner, who apparently had not had a starring role in a film for something like 40 years.
Whoa. Mm.
And always been one of my favorite actresses.
Thanks, Gwyneth.
Yeah. It's a way to suck all the air out of the room. I've always loved Blythe Danner and just found her just an actress I really love watching. And I've had to sort of settle for just tasty bits and supporting performances in movies like... Hello, I Must Be Going, or Another Woman, or whatever. Here's the lead. She plays a widow who has a fairly settled in life. She gardens, and she plays bridge with her friends, who are played by Mary Kay Place and Rhea Perlman and June Squibb.
Smokes weed with them, too.
Smokes weed with them occasionally. And then her dog dies, and her life is shaken up a bit. First, she becomes friends with her pool guy, played by Martin Starr. And then she finds herself being kind of romanced by Sam Elliott, and who doesn't want to be romanced by Sam Elliott. It's kind of like...
Everybody doesn't like something.
But nobody doesn't like Sam Elliott.
Exactly.
It's sort of the, you know, like if your mom wouldn't watch Grandma because it was about a lesbian...
And about abortions.
She'll watch this one, you know. So it's kind of the tamer Grandma. But nicely done for that, and just a rare opportunity to see Blythe Danner really get to do a lot of things, and
old people get laid in this movie.
Yeah,
too.
And it just, you know, it's you know, Hollywood does not give its women enough opportunities, and certainly not its women of a certain age. And so, just this chance to watch Blythe Danner carry a movie is enough for me. So yeah, it's worth checking out. Bill?
Because it's the Halloween season, my favorite time of year, I think I'm going to recommend Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. It is the Halloween sequel that has nothing to do with Michael Myers.
Right.
And it's crazy bonkers. It's in recent years, it's become much more appreciated. It was a bomb when it came out.
Yeah,
and
the cult has grown, certainly.
Yeah, it's... I kind of
And the president of that cult, his name is Brian Fuller. Yeah.
But
every day during October, his Facebook posts. That's all he talks about.
I share his love, and I was with some people last night, and so many people hadn't seen it. I was like, "How could you have not seen it?" I mean, it's not necessarily what you'd call good, but it's very watchable, and it's the most Halloween-y movie, maybe besides Trick or Treat, that is out there.
Sure. I like the idea of Halloween 3, and I think there are certain sequences that are really fun. A lot of it is terrible.
Yes, but in a fun, crazy way. Like, the lead is an alcoholic doctor. He carries a six-pack with him between scenes. Like, when they try to find him, they find him at a bar in the afternoon. He's the hero.
A lot of the movie is set at a very nondescript motel in the middle of nowhere.
In Santa Mira. Santa Mira, California, just like Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
There's a lot of stuff going on.
The ending is great. You have to sit through a lot to get there, but it's worth it for the great
movie. I think it's all great. Yeah.
It's shot by Dean Cundey, who was like a big DP for Spielberg, and before that, John Carpenter.
And it's
gorgeous to look at. And when's the last time you saw it? It's been a while?
No, a couple years ago at Brian's house. That was when
to Brian's house during the month of October without it being.
It was seeing it as an adult. I realized, oh, this isn't all that good.
You mean like the Goosebumps thing from
exactly,
when you're
exactly because you know, I it came on the movie channel all the time when I was in like my early teens and I dug it.
See, I didn't like it when I was young. I was like, there's no Michael Myers, and I recently watched the Blu-ray. Well, I'd liked it before that, but when I watched the Blu-ray, I had much bigger appreciation for it.
It never bothered me they didn't have Michael Myers. I thought their idea of we're going to make a Halloween movie every year, and Michael Myers was just one story. We're going to
American Horror Story is now. They did it before.
It was
going to
be kind of like a series anthology sort of thing. And I thought, oh, that's a cool idea, and I love the way this movie ends and the whole idea behind it. But then, yes, I started seeing it again a few years later. I was like, oh, God, get on with it. And why are we in this motel? But it's worth seeing, for sure. Yeah. If you've never seen it, you owe it to yourself to watch it.
I'm going
to
do a couple letters.
All right.
Including this one that I believe I have read before.
You have not, I'm telling you.
You say that we haven't read it before, and I say we have.
I'm telling you we have not.
But just to cover our bases, I'm going to do it. Again, I think.
No.
This is
back
from,
me up on this, listeners.
This is from Kevin.
Okay.
Hello, I'm a Canadian listener who recently found himself staying in a California resident friend's unair-conditioned guest room while on vacation. Never again will I scoff or roll my eyes when you guys complain about the weather. While in California, I managed to see a screening of Akira Kurosawa's Yojimbo at the New Beverly and eat at Chick-fil-A. Sorry. At one point, while driving down the highway, Kevin and Bean came on the radio. You will be pleased to know that they do, in fact, still suck. I subjected my girlfriend to about 15 minutes of their show and my constant mocking commentary. She asked why I wanted to listen to something I clearly disliked so fervently, and I told her that openly mocking them in the presence of another person was my way of avenging my pretend Uncle Dave. Briefly, for those of you who don't know this story, I was on Kevin and Bean.
I didn't know this.
10 years ago to talk about Brokeback Mountain. And within 3 minutes of my time on this show, they asked me if I was trying to make my voice sound straight for the radio. And I said, nope, this is just how I talk. And if you don't think this is how a gay guy talks, then you don't know enough gay guys. And then they hung up on me. I was an invited guest, by the way. Anyway,
Yeah, so, go back to our Do I Sound Gay episode. Yeah, we tell this
story
in detail.
When we talk about the documentary Do I Sound Gay, we talked about this. And then he goes on to say, I cannot wait until the Exile and Guyville audiobook is complete. I'll give you as many of my pathetic Canadian dollars as you will take. The Exile and Guyville audiobook is still in the process of being edited by a good friend of ours. He says October 30th or 31st.
Woo!
So it may be your Halloween treat. I'm going to confirm that with him this week.
Silver Shamrock.
Yeah. okay. Recently, who's this letter from? This letter is from, I'm scrolling down to the name of the person who wrote this letter, Miriam, who is a friend of the show. She has talked to us before. Recently, you mentioned the movie Bridge to Terabithia. I myself did not actually read the book in school, but I heard of it frequently, and I know another reading group read it when I was in fifth grade. What's going on outside?
I don't know.
Probably. It's Sunday. While my reading group was reading A Wrinkle in Time, I thought I should watch the movie before writing to you all. Though it doesn't really influence what I was going to say, I discovered through Facebook a few years ago that the story was inspired by an actual little girl who was killed by lightning.
Oh.
And that the girl was the sister of the mother of a girl with whom I went to high school.
Wow.
Yeah. I realize that sounds tenuous, but both my classmate and her mother have posted about it. It's odd to think about because it happened in the 1970s, but the story is still so present in the culture. I believe the family appreciates this, though. In any event, the girl I went to school with now has a PhD in psychedelic studies. That's a thing you can have a PhD in. I don't think she has any strong association with any organized Christian denomination. My one opinion on the movie, other than that it was surprisingly good, but probably at more of a seventh grade level, relates to the music. The kids at home seem to be watching a non-MTV music video channel, which I will assume was a Christian music video channel. There was also on the soundtrack some totally nondescript pop and rock music, with a female vocalist like Demi Lovato, but not, which I will assume was the Christian music Demi Lovato. Yet, when Zooey Deschanel has the kids sing in the music class sequences, they were singing regular famous songs of the secular radio, and not even like public domain folk songs. I found that curious.
Well, I'm wondering if the songs in the movie, I mean, because this isn't a hardcore Christian movie
the way
something like God's Not Dead is.
Right.
So it might just be that the songs they're listening to are sort of generic pop songs that they could get for the movie and not necessarily Christian songs, unless you picked up that they were out and out Christian songs. I don't know.
And one more. This is very short. It's from listener Ed. He offers a title for the Purge Christmas film. The Purge Christmas film that I want that has cannibalism in it.
Yes.
Binge and Purge, : A Very Cannibal Christmas. Thank you, Ed. The end.
There was, do you remember the Christian music video channel they had in Dallas? ZTV?
Yes.
Because for a while I was living in an apartment building where for some reason that was the default channel it would go back to when you turned your TV on. So I found myself watching it, and it was sort of fascinating because it was the mid-90s, so you would get like, here's the Christian Wilson Phillips, and here's the Christian Pet Shop Boys. And I was kind of like, yeah, I see what you're going for here, but it's not really working.
Did they play the Christian hair metal? Is that right? Striper? Isn't Striper one of them?
Was it Petra, I know? Was it Striper Christian too?
Striper was Christian. Yeah. Petra was Christian.
Yeah. I don't remember if that was too edgy for ZTV or not. All right. So, Bill, where can people find you online? Are you on Twitter?
I am not. I am. Oh, well, actually, I am on Twitter, but I have never posted.
Okay.
I think it's called BJ Cutterman.
Oh, cute.
Well, Bill Jr.
People can see your work at a theater near them. So,
Krampus and Crimson Peak and the Paranormal Activity trailers.
Okay, wow. Yeah. So awesome. Anyway, thank you for coming.
It was a delight. It's a dream come true.
Well, it was exciting to get some insight on how we are duped into seeing movies
Not
that we otherwise
duped.
Wouldn't.
Well,
I hope you're ashamed of yourself.
No. But I do not think we dupe people. I think we're all people who make these are we're all fans. Yeah. Sure. And so hopefully you find something that you like.
You're putting the best foot forward.
100%. Yes. That's right.
Fair enough. All right, folks. Thank you for quick reminder that our latest
I don't think you're duping anyone.
Our Linoleum Knife presents more Linoleum Knife episode for Gentlemen Prefer Blondes is now available. You can PayPal us $1.99 at Linoleum Podcast.
So inexpensive.
At gmail.com and include your email. We'll send it right to you. You can also order our previous commentary episodes for What's Up Doc, The Poseidon Adventure, Two for the Road, Josie and the Pussycats, Clue, The Apple, White Christmas, and Santa Claus. Those are all available. We're happy to send any of them to you. They're $1.99 each. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney. Dennis, Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Rotten Tomatoes podcast, the Bret Easton Ellis podcast, the Joel Ryan thing, Sewers of Paris, the Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion cast, Film Spotting SVU, the Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. We thank Blue for our wonderful theme music. You can find out more of his great stuff at Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. You can review the show at iTunes and subscribe there for free, obviously. What's our review this week, Dave? I sent it to you. I sent you the review that we got on iTunes this week.
Oh.
Yeah. Who is it from?
Wait, hang on.
Because people like to hear their name.
It's coming soon. As soon as I reopen my Word document.
You see what I have to work with?
I have it. It's in the thing. I just clicked.
It's not because he doesn't care.
Opening.
No, it's because he can't.
And I... No. It's just... There's any second now. I'm going to get to it. I'm scrolling down through all the backup of letters. It's at the very bottom of the document. Here we go. Almost there. It's... It is a...
82 Halloween. Halloween.
This review is from Jen... 22221111117979853.
Wow.
A lot of gems out there.
How did you remember that?
That's her name. She says she's a huge fan.
Yay.
5 stars. She's been reading my reviews, she says, since 2007. I'm honest and hilarious, she says.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then when I quit that job at that website.
Yes.
She found the show. Mm. This is very nice. People have done that. I'm very happy that that's actually happened.
You're skipping the part where finding the show meant she discovered me and my awesomeness.
You. Stuff about you. Yeah,
it's always, oh, Dave, you're so good. I agree with you on everything, Dave. You're so smart, Dave.
The Christian Wilson Phillips was called Point of Grace.
Ah. Oh.
Just so you know.
Did you just look that up?
No, I knew that.
POG.
Anyway, subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also stream us for free at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com and leave us positive feedback there. We have a Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast, where we post all kinds of fun stuff. Please go like that.
Instagram, too.
I'm getting there. Follow us.
I'm helping you get there.
Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast. And again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We have some top 10 lists that we have not read yet, but we will get to them soon. But you can send us those, send us commentary, feedback.
I need to do the top 10. I don't know.
Yes, nice. You should. Yeah. You should totally. If you want to send us your top 10 horror before Halloween, we could totally. Right. That would be fun. Yeah. All right. Anyway, you guys are great. We thank you for listening. Tell a friend about the show and catch you next time.
Oh, what did you?
No.
Oh.
Goodbye.